Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor Ruth DeFries. Ruth DeFries is Denning Family Professor of Sustainable Development and Chair, Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology, E3B, at Columbia University. Professor DeFries' research examines human transformation of the landscape and its consequences for climate, biogeochemical cycling, biodiversity, and other ecosystem services that make our planet habitable. The work is based on the premise that land use change involves trade-offs between human necessities, such as food, and unintended environmental consequences, such as greenhouse gas emissions and habitat loss. A particular focus is tropical deforestation and its impacts on atmospheric carbon emissions and conservation. The research analyzes land use changes over broad scales through the lens of satellite observations. Professor DeFries is actively involved in linking scientific information into policy decisions. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ruth DeFries.
Thank you for that introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming tonight. It's wonderful to be here at the Commonwealth Club, and great to be in San Francisco, and even better to see that you got a few drops of rain today. I hope you get some more. I've been squinting at satellite data for a few decades now from all parts of the world, and one thing is abundantly clear. Our human imprint on the planet is almost everywhere. Everywhere we see roads, buildings, cities, and many places we see farms, fields, pastures. Our imprint is just very pervasive on this planet. We are the species that dominates the planet. You can see that when you look out of an airplane window. You can see that when you look at Google Earth. It's just the state of the planet now is that we are the dominating force. So what does that mean? People interpret that in different ways. On one hand, some people will look at that image and point to our hubris, that we are doomed, that we are destroying nature, that we are headed toward calamity, climate change, droughts, fires, that we've just manipulated nature to such a point that we have some catastrophes in store. That's what you'll usually hear from an ecologist side. On the other side, you might hear from a more economist side that there's nothing to worry about. There's always a technology, a techno fix that can solve every problem, that we just need to wait for that solution to emerge. So we often hear these very polarized sides, that either we're headed for doom or that we have nothing to worry about. Ingenuity will always solve our problems. I don't think either of those extremes are particularly useful or particularly productive. If we're doomed, then we're doomed. Why should we work to make things better? And that an assumption that there will always be a technological fix is also not productive, because that's quite an assumption and it may turn out not to be the case. So what I was looking for in this book was to get away from these two extreme oversimplifications of our dominant role on the planet, and look at the complexity behind that question, because I think it's in between those, that neither of those extremes serve us well. And what's the complexity and nuance between those that can maybe guide us forward? So what I wanted to do in this book, which was something new for me, and it was a lot of fun, was to take a big step backwards in time and ask the question about how did we get to this point? How did we become the species that dominates the planet? Are there patterns? Are there, what can we learn about the future by looking at the past? So that was the question going way back in time, starting with the 4.5 billion years, really, when the planet formed out of massive gases, and look at our evolution to see what we can learn about how we became the dominant species on the planet. And we have become the dominant species on the planet. There have been other species in the hominid line, our early ancestors, who have all gone extinct for one reason or the other. We are the remaining Homo sapiens. And in our short tenure, and as you can see from that timeline, that our tenure is very short compared to some of our ancestors, we have just extended our reach to such an extent like no other species has done before. And my perspective on this is how this happened is that a lot of it has to do with food and how we produce food and how we manipulate nature, not in a pejorative way, but how we use nature to produce so much food. We're 7 billion something people, and it's just a pretty amazing feat to produce all of this food. And that is our closest connection with nature, is the way that we produce food. So I look at this through the lens of food. Now about half of the land area in the world is devoted to producing food for our one species in one form or another, which is quite amazing. So when we ask this question about how did we get to this point that we're so dominant and we've manipulated nature to produce so much food, we cannot ignore the role of the amazing planet that we live in, which is the foundation for nature that can provide us with so much food. So there's no other planet that we know of yet that is habitable and can support the diversity of life like we have on our planet. And there's a whole chapter devoted to this in the book about this confluence of kind of random factors that make our planet so habitable, like the right distance from the sun, plate tectonics, and very importantly, the planetary machinery that keeps nutrient cycling, that keeps carbon, which is the basis of life, carbon cycling, nitrogen cycling, phosphorus cycling, this planetary machinery we have. And that's largely what we've manipulated to produce so much food. So we have this amazing planet, but that's not where, that doesn't explain why we are the dominant species that we are, because there are millions of other species on this planet, and they don't dominate the way that we do. We're not chimps and bonobos in this room talking about this. Our closest ape relatives, we're humans. So there is a strong cultural aspect of this question as well, and there's another whole chapter in the book devoted to that how our ingenuity has allowed us to become, to use these characteristics of the planet to produce so much food. So we are a species that is different from others in the way that we accumulate knowledge. So many other species learn, but we learn and we pass that knowledge on to our peers, on to future generations, and they take that knowledge and they make it better, and they pass it on to their peers and their future generations, and we have this incredible ability to accumulate knowledge, acquire new ways of manipulating nature. So this combination of this amazing planet that we have and the culture that we have, which allows us to accumulate knowledge, is the platform for the whole story that follows in the book. So for most of our time on this planet, about 200,000 years, we were hunter-gatherers, foraging for our food, hunting like most other species do. And in the last 10,000 years, we joined a small cadre of other species who farm. So leafcutter ants are one of those farming species, some termites, some beetles. They figured out how to farm millions of years ago. We figured it out something like 10 or 12,000 years ago through selecting the plants that had desirable traits that we like to eat and that could be harvested and so on, and breeding those, and over time domesticating a pretty small handful of plants compared to all of the diversity of plants on the planet, and animals as well. So about 10 or 12,000 years ago, we joined these other species, all of whom have complex societies, all of whom have never reverted back to being non-farming species. So when we made that fateful, very fateful transition from being foragers to being farmers, many things happened. That was just a pivotal change in our relationship with nature. So one thing that happened was our population grew something like fivefold because it was possible to produce more food on less land and store grains. So population took off. It was a population explosion. We think about the population explosion of the current day, but it was a population explosion when we went through that transition. But a lot of other problems came in the wake as well. Disease, like smallpox and tuberculosis, emerged from crowded conditions with livestock. Our diets became starchier and less diverse. People were shorter. Life expectancy declined. Societies became hierarchical and stratified because there was a surplus that was possible to control. So we created this amazing transition, an amazing pivot that allowed population to grow, but created problems in its wake. So that's the cycle that repeats over the course of 10,000 years that's laid out in the book. One of the very big problems that farming created was with soil fertility. So when there's settled farming, the nutrients get into the crops, and then those are taken away in the form of vegetables, grains, whatever we eat, and then people eat that somewhere else. And unless there's a way to mimic the natural recycling process, the soil is going to lose its fertility and won't be able to grow enough food, and that's the end of civilization. So we've been struggling with this problem up until the current day, and are still struggling with this problem about how to keep soils fertile. So the ancient Chinese had a solution to this problem of soil fertility, which is maybe not very pleasant to talk about, but it worked for them, and it kept Chinese society going for a long time to support high-dense populations, the largest cities in the world at the time. So what they did was collect the human waste from people living in the cities, in the settlements, towns, and taking it back to the field. So that keeps the natural recycling process going, the nitrogen and phosphorus, which is so important for crops to grow. So that's how they were able to keep soils fertile. So Victor Hugo, in the 19th century, French writer, has a observation of that, and he said that not a Chinese peasant goes to town without bringing back with him at two extremities of his bamboo pole two full buckets of what we designate as filth. So it may have been filth, but it certainly worked for the Chinese, along with plant-based diets that kept civilization going. This wasn't only in China. In London as well, in New York as well, there were night men, this is all euphemistic terms, night men who collected the night soil and carried it back to the fields. And this was a way to keep soils fertile, a very clever, ingenious way to mimic the natural cycle. So this went on into the Industrial Revolution, and then the cities grew and grew with the Industrial Revolution in London, to the point where it was just not feasible to collect all this waste and bring it back to the cities anymore. It just became too big of a effort to deal with. So then there needs to be a new solution. So this was around the time, late 18th century, when Thomas Malthus issued his very famous dire predictions of calamity, that food shortages were inevitable because population was growing exponentially and food was growing in a linear way, and there was going to be a crash and famines and population would decline. So that was the Malthus prediction. We hear that repeated often in the current day. He was making those predictions in the context of lack of clarity about how soils were going to stay fertile, and as well as a few years of drought. So that was his context, and it made sense from the context that he lived in. But what he didn't see was that there was another pivot around the corner, that there was another way to keep soils fertile. So this is the theme of the book, of this cycle of problems that are created, ratcheting up the population, committing civilization to finding a way to keep all those people fed, and then a pivot, human ingenuity, to figure out something else. So these other pivots in keeping soils fertile came from all kinds of different ways. So a few decades after Malthus issued his warnings, the Alexander Humboldt, who was a German explorer, he took an expedition to South America, and he brought back all kinds of things, bark and rocks and grass and all kinds of specimens. And one of the specimens that he brought back was bird guano, which collected in deep, deep piles in the islands off the coast of South America, because that's a dry environment and lots of birds and lots of, you can imagine for yourself. That guano turned out to be excellent fertilizer. The Incans had been using for centuries and centuries. They knew about the fertilizing power of the guano. And when Humboldt brought that back to Europe, that set off a booming commercial trade. Lots of money to be made in this guano trade. Led to wars between Spain and Chile and Bolivia and Peru. In the course of those wars, Bolivia ended up being landlocked. Peru ended up having a booming economy and then a collapsing economy once the guano was used up. So inevitably, there was a shortage of guano because the birds couldn't replenish in the amount that the guano was being taken out. So that was a couple of decades. Temporary solution. So here we have, that's the theme. There are temporary solution after temporary solution. Another temporary solution was the bison bones on the prairie. As European settlers moved across the prairie, there was the slaughter of the bison, and what was left behind was a lot of skulls, a lot of bones, and a good source of phosphorus. Bones are a good source of phosphorus, which is essential for fertilizer. So again, a cottage industry sprung up of people scavenging those bones and loading them in trains and setting them back east to factories to turn those bones into fertilizer. So here again was another temporary solution. Eventually those bones got used up, and here we are. Now what are we going to do to keep soils fertile? In the early 20th century, then, there was a very pivotal moment in our history when it became possible to fertilize soil by chemical synthetic means. So scientists had figured out in the 1800s, most notably von Liebig, a German scientist, that plants could grow not just with organic fertilizer like bird poop or human excrement, but could also be fertilized by salts and rocks and synthetic means. So this was really a very pivotal, transformative concept, which really did change the course of civilization. So in the early 20th century, Fritz Haber figured out, after many people had been trying for a long time, how to take the nitrogen in the atmosphere. So our atmosphere has abundant nitrogen as nitrogen gas in the atmosphere, the most common gas in the atmosphere. But the problem is that that nitrogen gas is not in a form that plants can use. And nitrogen is essential for plants to grow and for protein, for our protein. So that nitrogen has to be pulled apart. Those two nitrogen atoms need to be pulled apart and transformed into ammonia, which then can be taken up by, further converted by bacteria and then taken up by crops. So that's the irony, that we have this atmosphere that has abundant nitrogen gas, but it's in a form that plants can't use. So until it can be turned, what's called fixed, into ammonia, it's not much use to us. So what Haber figured out was how to pull that nitrogen out of the atmosphere, apply intense pressure, intense high temperatures, and make it into ammonia. Now, fertilizer wasn't the only reason why that was a highly sought technology, also because ammonia is essential, or was essential for making explosives. So in World War I, this was a very valuable technology for the Germans to be able to carry on the war. So when the war was over, the British had a tough time figuring out how was it that the Germans could keep the war going for so long and produce so many explosives. So when the war was over, the British went in and tried to figure out what this technology was. I mean, how do we get this technology to keep making explosives? And they couldn't quite figure it out, so they had to bribe some German engineers and a bit of industrial espionage to get that technology, which then spread to UK, other parts of Europe, North America. And when World War II came around, there were factories such as in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, to produce explosives for the war effort, for World War II. So here then, at the end of World War II, we have this capacity for converting this nitrogen gas into ammonia. The war's over. We don't need the explosives anymore. So what are we going to do with this technology? So then there were government programs to repurpose those factories to produce that ammonia and use it for fertilizer. So here we have a technology which is both extremely beneficial for humankind to grow our food and extremely detrimental in terms of killing people, basically. So Haber was a very interesting character. He had a very tragic life that you can read about in the book. He was accused of being a war criminal. His wife ended up committing suicide, a really tragic life. But he discovered this technology, which was so game-changing in the way that we produce food. So after World War II, then, the ability to synthesize fertilizer was really game-changing for agriculture. And we could grow monocultures and increase yields. Then the problem comes when we have monocultures, when we have a single species like a big cornfield, the problem comes with pests, because pests can move rapidly through the field, like what caused the problem of the Irish potato famine, which is another story in the book. So then what do we do about pests? So that's where the story of DDT comes in. DDT was hailed as a miracle for the World War II effort because it controlled malaria outbreaks and typhus outbreaks. And then after the war, again, it was hailed as a miracle for its agricultural applications to be able to control pests, which have, if you're a gardener, you know, pests are a really, really big problem. So DDT then was another big pivot in terms of our ability to produce more and more food. But again, DDT also brought its set of problems. Like all of these bring some kind of problem. There's a solution, and then there's a problem, and then there's another solution. So that's our cycle. That's our condition that we live with. So it was a few decades until the toxic effects of DDT came to be known. Rachel Carson and the then pivot to less toxic pesticides, but we're still living with this problem. So we have a way to control pests. We have a way to fertilize based on pulling nitrogen out of the air, phosphorus from digging them up from rocks. That's another story in the book. And then the problem comes, okay, so you can throw all this fertilizer onto the crops, and they grow so much and so tall that then they fall over, and you lose your crop. So here again, we have solutions which create another problem. So the solution to that problem came in the form of manipulating genetics again, the same way that we started out 10,000 years ago, manipulating genetics. So dwarf varieties of wheat came from Japan, and plant breeders worked very hard to be able to produce wheat and then other crops which are shorter in stature and they don't fall over, so that then the yields increased with that. So that was another big pivotal step. So we see here this cycle of problems, solutions, problems, solutions, growth, crisis, and that is what we live with. And that's what I think we will always be living with, because we're manipulating nature on such a grand scale, and nature is so complex we can't anticipate all the repercussions of what we're doing, that we're bound to create problems, and then we're such an ingenious species that we're bound to find new solutions to that. So going back to Malthus, he had gone wrong because he had extrapolated or made the assumption that the increase in food production is linear, which if you just look at your narrow window in time, that seems to make sense. But when you make that assumption over long time spans, that we don't see anything like this kind of linear progression, and we see a much more complex, nuanced picture where we have this cycle of figuring something out, which ratchets up the population, producing more food, leading to some kind of problem, whether it's shortage or some kind of environmental backlash. That's what I call the hatchet. And then figuring out something else. So there are lots of examples of individual collapses, which we all read about, Easter Island or the Mayans, or many examples where individual societies have collapse for complicated reasons, ecological combined with social and cultural reasons. But when we look over the, stand back from those individual examples and look at the whole course of human history, we see this very convoluted cycle where we have human ingenuity creating more problems, creating solutions. And then these solutions coming from all kinds of directions, whether it's industrial espionage, quirky accidents, repurposed war technologies, things that we would not be able to anticipate. If someone sat down to write 10,000 years ago, what's the course of human civilization going to be? It would have been impossible. Just impossible to see where these pivots are coming from. My favorite quirky story in the book is about the Rocky Mountain locust. Does anyone know the story of the Rocky Mountain locust? So North America is, well, think back to Little House on the Prairie, where, if you'll remember, one episode where the crop was decimated by locusts, and Pa Ingalls had to leave his family and go back east. We don't see that now. Rocky Mountain locusts went extinct, which was a great thing for the settlers and the farmers and families like the Ingalls. But why that happened is just an absolute quirk of fate. According to the ecologist, entomologist Jeff Lockwood in Montana, who unraveled this story. So what he unraveled was that the farmers plowed next to the streams, in the lowlands next to the streams, because that's a good place to farm, and those places were precisely the places where the locusts were breeding. So completely inadvertently, this twist of fate, the Rocky Mountain locust went extinct. Today, there are plagues in West Africa, throughout the world, and they're a huge, devastating tragedy for those farmers. But because of this quirk, the farmers had no idea that they were causing the Rocky Mountain locust to go extinct. Across the prairie, there were no more locust plagues, and we don't have them today. So that's a quirky example. That I particularly like that example, although the locusts did go extinct, sorry. But imagine what the course of this country might have been if agriculture had not expanded the way it did across the Midwest. Who knows? We can't rerun the experiment. But the outcome would have been different because agriculture was so important to the development of this country. So where does that take us today? So after these repeated cycles of ratchets and hatchets and pivots, in the last 50 years, all of these pivots came together. Irrigation, pesticides, fertilizers, manipulation of genetics, to culminate in what I call the big ratchet, which is the time when there has been an explosion in food production. All of these constraints of nature, which limited us in the past, were lifted in the last 50 years because of this accumulation of knowledge over 10,000 years, really. So there was a huge increase in the amount of food produced in the last 50 years. There was, if we look today, there's more food per person produced in the world on a global scale now than 50 years ago, and that's taking into account even the explosive growth in population. So the growth in the amount of food outpaced the growth in the population, which is an amazing, amazing feat, regardless of what you might think about the consequences. It's an amazing feat considering that we became farmers only 10,000 years ago. So we are quite an ingenious species. So when you go in a grocery store, it just seems so commonplace. We all go in the grocery store, we get our groceries, we go home, we cook dinner. But when I go into a grocery store, I just have to pinch myself. It's like it's just a museum of our whole historical development of how crops have moved to different places around the world, how we've manipulated these plants and animals to our liking, how we've processed these foods, how we move them around. It's just an amazing display for our everyday experience of going into the grocery store. So more and more people are getting their food from grocery stores. Another huge transition that we're going through now is that we are now an urban species, which is only possible if we have this abundance of food, surplus food, that can feed all of these people in the cities. So in 2007, we crossed the threshold. About half of us became urban dwellers, and it's expected that about 80% of people will be living in cities in the next couple of decades. So that, I think, we live in really very extraordinary times because of this abundance that we have, and that has enabled, or one of the aspects that has enabled us to have this transition from first being foragers to farmers, and now from farmers to urban species. And that just completely changes our relationship with nature, the way we get food, the way we think about nature, just a really transformative change. So following this cycle of problems that arise out of these solutions that we create, inevitably, we have problems from the big ratchet that we have just lived through, this enormous increase in the production of food. We're now living this legacy of the big ratchet, and we're following the same pattern that we've always followed. It's a different set of problems, but it's the same pattern of problems following solutions. One of the problems that this abundance has created for us takes the form of unhealthy diets and this epidemic of obesity and overweight, which is just spreading throughout the world. We tend to think about that in terms of the U.S., Europe, the industrialized world, but in the developing world as well, the spread of obesity is just phenomenal at lower and lower levels of income. So through the production of fats, oils, and sugars that are more abundant and more available, we're seeing this problem that our abundance has created in the form of this obesity epidemic. But on the at the same side, the other problem that this abundance has created is one of inequity. So we have something like 800 million people in this world who don't get enough food, who are undernourished, which is just a tragic thing to think about, considering that we have more than enough food to feed everyone in the world. So on one hand, we have this undernourishment. On the other hand, we have this overweight problem. So we have, for every 5 people who are underweight, there are something like 8 people who are overweight in the world. The number of underweight is declining, which is a great thing. The number of overweight is increasing. So here we have this problem of inequity. We have this emerging problem of obesity that is falling from this abundance that we have created. We also have this raft of environmental problems, greenhouse gases. Agriculture contributes about 1/4 of human-caused greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. Nitrogen runoff, like we saw in Toledo, Ohio, from toxic blooms created by nitrogen running off of the fields from excess fertilizer. This rash of environmental problems that falls out of this abundance that we have created. So where does this take us? So if we think about this cycle, we've been through this big ratchet. We are looking at the hatchets now. And can we devise the pivots that we need in time to keep this cycle going, this cycle of ingenuity? So I see some real hopeful signs that we are working on these pivots, maybe too slow, but it's all up to us to work on these pivots. And one is the attention that people are starting to pay, more and more attention that people are paying to their diets, and particularly the value of more plant-based diets, and how that benefits both the environment and benefits our health as well. So more and more people are paying attention to that, and it's been a real movement, as you all know, here in San Francisco. Over the last year. So that's seems to me a major pivot point. We're seeing a lot more attention about efficiency of the way we use nitrogen fertilizer, the way we use water, the way we grow our food to be much more efficient, which means there's less excess and less pollution remaining. We're seeing more composting and recycling, which goes back to the old ways that people kept soils fertile. And again, San Francisco is just a model for that. I'm so jealous, living in New York, of your composting system here. More attention to waste. About 1/2 of the food that's produced in the world is wasted in one way or the other. So there's a real opportunity to pivot in that way. So these pivots are starting to turn, and we're starting to see them. There's no guarantee. There's never a guarantee of the future that we will continue this pattern of using our ingenuity to get out of the problems that we create. But if history is our guide, and that's really the only guide we have, and we all work on these pivots, then we can continue this cycle. So what do we see from this step way back and this long arc of looking at how we have manipulated species, the planet? We see that we are an ingenious species. We see that we have solved many problems. We see that Feeding civilization is a massive exercise of manipulating nature and taking advantage of what nature has to offer us. And it's a series of experiments. It's successes and failures. There's no end point. Whatever pivot we may devise in the future, there will inevitably be problems. We can never conclude that we've figured out how to feed civilization, check that off, and move on to the next thing. We will always be manipulating nature, creating problems, and solving problems. So does this leave us with a pessimistic or an optimistic view of the future? You could take a pessimistic view of this, that we are always vulnerable, that we are always experimenting, that we are always in this cycle. I tend to look at this story in an optimistic way, that we are very ingenious, that we have more knowledge than we've ever had before, that through the guide of history, we can expect this cycle to continue. So it's up to you for your interpretation of whether you take away a pessimistic or an optimistic story. I choose to take an optimistic view. I think that leads us forward in a better way than just throwing up our hands and giving up. So I hope you enjoy the book, and I hope it gives you a new perspective and a new way to think about our relationship with nature. Thank you.
Our thanks to Professor DeVries for her comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis, with Professor Ruth DeVries. Now we open the floor to a Q&A. Please keep your questions short and to the point. Also, please be sure that your questions are in fact questions and not the statement. Now, I'm going to pass around this microphone. If you have any questions, please raise your hand and speak into the microphone as we are recording.
Thank you. Very interesting. One of the big problems in the future for food is water supply. I mean, California is just getting rid of its groundwater. We don't have any rain this year. The glaciers are melting. How is this going to be overcome?
Yeah, water is indeed a very, very big constraint. So the question then comes: can we adapt to more efficient use of water, to grow crops that require less water, to grow crops in places where it's suitable to the amount of water that's available? So it's a question of can we adapt to what we know is a real constraint. Some places are very concerning about water, such as in India where the groundwater is declining. Again, it's a question of what crops should we grow where that can efficiently use the water that's available.
Next question. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the presentation. My question is that the ratchet seems based on aggregate population. Human beings are successful and that we continue to multiply. But we know that human population is supposed to crest somewhere around 2050. So how does the hatchet ratchet behavior change when human population crests?
Yeah. So actually, there's a new paper out today in the journal Nature, which revises the population estimates and said, I don't know if I believe it yet, I haven't read the paper in detail, but that population will continue to decline for the century, mostly because of growth in Africa. That aside, another reason why our times are different than the past is because what we're seeing is a leveling off of population growth for the first time at a global scale. Since the beginning of agriculture, perhaps. And that's because as people get wealthier and people have better lifestyles and as women have opportunities and girls have the opportunity to be schooled, then the fertility rate declines. Then people have smaller families. You can probably all think about that in your own family history. I certainly can. So we are, this decoupling of the food supply and population growth is really also a very transformative, different way of being as a species that we're seeing now, along with the urbanization. It goes along with the urbanization, too, because when people urbanize, they generally have smaller families.
Any other question? Well, I have a question.
Okay.
I know we have heard from some scientists that we are approaching the level where the planet cannot sustain the population of 9 billion, which we are approaching quickly. We may be already there. I don't follow the stats now, but so. But your presentation seems to suggest that we are not there yet, and we can live the way that we've been living. Or is there any way that we can, each one of us can do to help the planet for sustainable living?
Yeah. So I don't think we can continue to live the way that we've been living. We live a very sort of wasteful, luxuriant lifestyle in this country, at least. But the question is, can we adapt? Can we use our ingenuity to maintain our lifestyles or maintain a sufficient lifestyle in a way which is less damaging on the environment, in a way that resolves these problems of inequity, these problems that we have created? So these projections, like Malthus made, that we couldn't maintain this population growth, relates to the concept of carrying capacity. Ecologists tend to think that there's a fixed, finite number. But if we look at this complex story of human history, we see that applying that concept of carrying capacity is much more complex when we apply it to our species, that we are able to adapt, we're able to trade, we're able to apply technology. So this relationship between population and crashes is much more complex than it would be in other species.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Great talk, Ruth. Thanks.
Thanks, David.
So I have a kind of a practical question. I was thinking back to the ancient Chinese solution. Do you know how they finally figured out that, hey, our waste makes a great fertilizer? I mean, did they spit on the plants first? No, that doesn't work. And I mean, how do they wind up making the connection that we can recycle that our own waste and grow more food?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know exactly who figured it out or when exactly they figured it out. Perhaps I'm completely speculating here that animal manure on the farm is a good fertilizer. Perhaps the connection was made that way. It's a great question. And then in the 19th century, there was so much science in Europe around this question of soil fertility and figuring out, as I said, that it's possible to fertilize plants without organics, with salts. So there was a lot of science there and a lot of experiments. There's a famous experimental station in the UK, which is still running, which did lots and lots of experiments, figuring out that clover puts nitrogen back into the soil. The ancient Chinese knew that. Ancient Egyptians knew that. So this ingenuity that we have goes way, way back. They couldn't have known the mechanisms that we know now, but they were very ingenious. Because they had to be. They had to be.
Thanks, Ruth. It was a great talk.
Thanks.
So I'm wondering about the time frame for actually the in between the time you ratchet up and you hatch it back and you come up with these pivots. Do you see the frequency, the time between the pivots tightening over time so that we will go through these transitions very quickly in the next 50 years to come to a solution given our body of knowledge, or do you see that those stay, those timelines stay pretty constant and we're in for a pretty interesting ride in the next 40 years until we actually figure out the next solution?
Yeah. Well, we're in for an interesting ride. That's for sure. And our problems are bigger and on a global scale, which makes our times different. Whether we pivot in time, that's really up to us. That's up to the work that we do, the way we live our lives, what society chooses as its priorities. So we can't predict the future. Somehow, crisis has a way of kicking solutions into gear. We have a lot more knowledge now, so we have the ability to pivot if that's what we choose to do. But it's up to us.
Thank you. A couple more questions.
Hello, Reed Luce, and I'll try to be brief. My question is, how do you reach out to people who simply have no understanding of the environment? Now, if I can, I'll just give you a very brief example. I went down to Nicaragua, which is a complete ecological disaster. But they have in Nicaragua a place called the Mesquite Forest, which you would think of as a jungle. And I went over there, and of course my concern was boa constrictors, because they're disappearing, believe it or not, in Nicaragua. The question I have to you is, after I went through this forest and came out 3 days later, thinking I had gone through a huge adventure, I went to a little restaurant, and the restaurant was selling boa constrictors and bazootis, which is a little tiny anteater, and that's what the people were having for lunch, and this place had a thriving business. And I thought, you know, as a mercenary in the army of capitalism, the first thing I thought is, well, maybe I can buy these animals. But you couldn't buy the animals because that would take away the restaurant's food supply, and the people in the local area would get upset. My question is, how do you deal with this kind of frustration where you literally can go to a nation of 6 million people and the problem is simply not even addressed? I mean, it's just not there.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of scope for education, huge scope for education. And I think once people have an opportunity to think about this amazing planet that we live on, yes, there are human needs and the restaurant needs its food supply. But once people can have the opportunity, and most people do not have the opportunity to appreciate what nature does for us and just the amazing planet that we live on. So there's really a huge need for education.
Hi. My question is about the nature of the problem and solution. Most of the problems and solutions you spoke about were more technology-based, but now since we're kind of so abstracted away from food production, we're having more problems on a society level and a policy level. Do you see that as being one of the bigger... what are your thoughts on that, basically, and how can we counter that? Because it seems like a technology problem is almost more immediate to solve, the scope of it, versus the society one isn't.
Yeah. So technology can never exist in a vacuum. All of the examples of technology were in the context of the society that they were in, like, for example, the ability to synthesize nitrogen being in the context of needing explosives for war. So technology is never isolated from the cultural context that it's in. But as you say, we do have technologies. We do know how to use nitrogen efficiently. We know how we could apply a lot of our knowledge to these pivots, and it's a question of priorities about whether we choose to do that. So again, that's up to us. What kind of society do we want?
Thank you. Our thanks to Professor DeVries for her comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.